Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 443, titled The Serpent's Diaries, Part 2, subtitled Neo-Nazis and 9/11. This program is being recorded on January 25th of the year 2004. Before we get into the substance of the broadcast, let me remind you, first of all, that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DAVEEMORY. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website as well. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program 443 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. People have inquired about how to assist the work that I'm doing. At the beginning of each description of the For the Record programs, there is a notation on the web that you can click on in order to help support the work that I'm doing. Now, For the Record 443, again, is titled Serpent's Diaries, Part 2, subtitled Neo-Nazis and 9/11. The title is a contraction of two books published by National Vanguard Books, The Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk, both of which I've used extensively in the past. National Vanguard Books is the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic Nazi group. And what we're going to be looking at during the course of this broadcast is evidentiary tributaries running between the events in and around September 11th and the so-called neo-Nazi milieu, particularly the National Alliance. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from Counterpunch magazine. The URL for this will be available on the description. Counterpunch is put out by Alexander Coburn. This article is titled Neo-Nazis and 9/11 by Jack McCarthy. It's dated October 29th of 2001. Skipping down in the article, about Dr. William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance and the author of the Turner Diaries, we read, "Upon perusing Pierce's speeches from 1988 and 99, I discovered that Pierce, who heads the National Alliance, did indeed utter some most interesting pre-September 11th, if not prophetic, remarks about Osama bin Laden and bioterrorism. The running theme in Pierce's commentaries is, to paraphrase his hero Hitler, that Osama bin Laden's warning to America is, 'I am coming, and so is bioterrorism.' In one chilling commentary, Pierce, after noting that bin Laden and the rest of the lost generation of angry Muslim youth had had it with their parents' compromises and were hell-bent on revenge against infidel America, issued this stark prophetic warning in a 1998 radio address titled, 'Stay Out of Tall Buildings.' Quote, 'New Yorkers who work in tall office buildings anything close to the size of the World Trade Center might consider wearing hard hats,' Pierce warned, and again, this was in 1998. Skipping down in this article, also recall that one of Pierce's followers, the notorious Nevada-based microbiologist Wayne Harris, that's actually Larry Wayne Harris, has been arrested twice over the last decade, once for possession of bubonic plague materials, and the other for possessing and allegedly planning to use anthrax. We've talked about Larry Harris and the anthrax scare in For the Record 89, and we discussed that in the context of the late Dr. Larry Ford, who worked variously for the South African Project Coast Biological Warfare Program from the apartheid era, also the Central Intelligence Agency at the same time. And Larry Ford also had been working for what appears to have been an underground Bruderbond milieu and had strong connections to the right-wing militia and Aryan Nations milieu. More about that later in the program. We discussed overlapping areas of operation between Pierce and Larry Wayne Harris in For the Record program number 419. Now, note again that in 1998, William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, warned in a radio address titled Stay Out of Tall Buildings, quote, New Yorkers who work in tall office buildings anything close to the size of the World Trade Center might consider wearing hard hats. That is more than a little interesting, and what we're going to be doing during the course of this broadcast is taking a look at evidentiary tributaries and paths of investigation that run between the first World Trade Center attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, the attacks of September 11th, the anthrax attacks, as yet not only unsolved, but if you'll notice, completely ignored by the media establishment. Listeners should stop and ask themselves, when was the last time they heard anybody in the media commenting about the anthrax attacks? We're going to be looking at evidentiary tributaries running between those events and the neo-Nazi terror group The Order from the 1980s that was inspired by the Turner Diaries. And we're going to be taking a look at some interesting links between not only the white supremacist slash neo-Nazi milieu in the United States, but between some of the Islamists and Islamo-fascists who figure in the events in and around September 11th. We're going to review now an element that we looked at in For the Record 441, also in For the Record 399 and 397. William Pierce, the late William Pierce, who died of a fast-acting case of cancer in early 2002, around the early summer, William Pierce was the author of the Turner Diaries. He wrote under the nom de plume of Andrew MacDonald, reviewing very quickly the climactic event in the Turner Diaries. Quote, the I here is Earl Turner, the fictional author of the Turner Diaries. I conferred privately with Major Williams of the Washington Field Command for more than an hour on the problem of attacking the Pentagon. The military's other major command centers were either knocked out on September 8th or subsequently consolidated with the Pentagon, which the top brass apparently regard as impregnable. And it damn near is. We went over every possibility we could think of, and we came up with no really convincing plan except perhaps one. That is to make an air delivery of a bomb. In the massive ring of defenses around the Pentagon, there is a great deal of anti-aircraft firepower, but we decided that a small plane flying just above the ground might be able to get through the 3-mile gauntlet with one of our 60-kiloton warheads. One factor in favor of such an attempt is that we have never before used aircraft in such a way, and we might hope to catch the anti-aircraft crews off their guard. Although the military is guarding all civil airfields, it just happens that we have an old crop duster stashed in a barn only a few miles from here. My immediate assessment is to prepare a detailed plan for an aerial attack on the Pentagon by next Monday. We must make a final decision at the time, and then act without further delay. November 9th, 1993. It's still 3 hours until first light and all systems are go. I'll use the time to write a few pages, my last diary entry. Then it's a one-way trip to the Pentagon for me. The warhead is strapped into the front seat of the old Stearman and rigged to detonate either on impact or when I flip a switch in the back seat. Hopefully, I'll be able to manage a low-level airburst directly over the center of the Pentagon. Failing that, I'll at least try to fly as close as I can before I'm shot down. It's been more than 4 years since I've flown, but I've thoroughly familiarized myself with the Stearman cockpit and been briefed on the plane's peculiarities. I don't anticipate any piloting problems. The barn hangar here is only 8 miles from the Pentagon. We'll thoroughly warm up the engine in the barn, and when the door is opened, I'll go like a bat out of hell straight for the Pentagon at an altitude of about 50 feet. And then the Turner Diaries ends. By the way, I would note that November 9th is a date viewed as having occult significance as well as historical significance for the Nazi movement. November 9th was the date of the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923 and Die Kristallnacht in 1938. The Berlin Wall also came down on November 9th of 1989. The concluding passage of this section of the Turner Diaries, thus end Earl Turner's diaries as unpretentiously as they began. His final mission was successful, of course, as we are all reminded each year on November 9th, our traditional Day of the Martyrs. So note that the climactic episode in the Turner Diaries, authored by William Pierce, is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon involving the use of a crop-dusting aircraft. I would note that some of the September 11th hijackers, including Zaharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, whom we're going to talk about in a few minutes, were looking into obtaining crop dusters. Crop dusters are not particularly sophisticated aircraft, but they can fly very, very low, and they have a very small turning radius. They can also obviously distribute biological weapons and chemical weapons as well. What we're going to do now is to review an element that we looked at in For the Record 386, and this concerns an evidentiary tributary running between the first World Trade Center bombing, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, Ramzi Youssef, and the Oklahoma City bombing as well. One of the things that we've discussed in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record 386, is the fact that one of the templates that was apparently used to craft the September 11th attacks was Operation Bojinka. That is Serbo-Croatian for Big Bang. It was a plan to hijack a bunch of airliners over the Pacific, U.S. airliners, and destroy them with all people on board being killed. That plan was masterminded by Ramzi Youssef. An article in the Manila Times from the spring of 2002 discussed a deathbed confession by a woman named Elmina Abdul, the widow of one of the co-founders of Abu Sayyaf, a fellow named Edwin Angeles. Now, Abu Sayyaf is the Philippine affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Edwin Angeles, as we've looked at in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record program number 92, was a fellow who was going to be a witness at the trial of Timothy McVeigh, but Judge Mache, who also presided over the trial of The Order, the neo-Nazi terror group who killed Alan Berg, Judge Mache would not allow Edwin Angeles to give evidence. In this article from the Manila Times, it is alleged that Edwin Angeles, in addition to being one of the co-founders of Abu Sayyaf, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Philippines, was also present at a meeting in which he saw Terry Nichols, nicknamed the Farmer by these Islamofascists, present at a meeting that discussed not only plans for Operation Bojinka, but plans to blow up a United States government building. And it appears that that was in Oklahoma. This article was authored by Dorian Zumel Sikat. It's from the Manila Times of April 2nd of 2002. The full URL at which this can be accessed will be put on the description. It's titled Deathbed Confession, Abu. That's a reference to Abu Sayyaf, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Philippines. Abu, Part of Oklahoma Blast, again by Dorian Zumel Sikat, Manila Times, April 2nd, 2002. It reads in part as follows. The woman in question here is Elmina Abdul, who was interviewed on her deathbed. She was dying of cancer, and this deathbed confession was witnessed by Basilan Provincial Information Officer Christopher Puno, last name P-U-N-O. Skipping down on the article, quote, Elmina was Edwin's fourth and last wife. She met him in 1995 while he was in the Basilan Provincial Jail. They were married in 1997, almost a year before Angeles was summarily executed in Basilan in 1998. What she told me at that final interview was at once revealing and shocking. Edwin had told him Elmina the entire chronicle of his experience as a co-founder of the Abu Sayyaf group and a deep cover agent of the Department of National Defense beginning in 1991. Edwin told her that he expected to be killed soon, and he was. Among the most interesting revelations that Angeles shared with Elmina was about a meeting between himself, Ramzi Youssef, Abdul Murad, both of whom are now serving multiple prison terms for terrorist activities, including the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, Abdurazak Akubakar Janjalani, unidentified members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, and two men who Angeles identified only as Iraqis. I would say that one should consider the possibility that they were from another Middle Eastern country as well. The meeting, according to Elmina, was held in a warehouse near a Dole Philippines plant in South Cotabato between General Santos City and Davao del Sur. There were two other men at that meeting, a man whom Angeles identified as Nichols and as codename Farmer, and another American whom he did not identify by name. It's important to note that most Filipinos commonly describe Caucasians in the country as Americans. The meeting, according to Elmina, took place in 1994. She could not remember the exact date. In that meeting, according to Elmina, Angeles told her that the major topic of the discussion was the bombing of specified targets and how to build bombs. Angeles also told Elmina that Nichols was later sent to a place that he, Angeles, didn't name for more detailed instruction on how Nichols and his other American friend could build a bomb to destroy a building in the United States. She did not specify, she could not remember, which building that was to be. Elmina also told me that before he was gunned down, Edwin showed her documents that proved that he actually was a deep cover agent for the Department of National Defense of the Philippines. He said that those documents were presented in court in his defense, and that was the reason that he was acquitted of the charges against him. That is a matter of record. But since I have never seen the documents, I will not name the high-ranking defense officials whose signatures were said to appear on those documents. And again, remember that Operation Bojinka, talked about here, was the template for the 9/11 attacks. Continuing, Angeles also told Elmina about Project Bojinko, an allegedly Iraqi-financed operation of terror that targeted several buildings in the U.S., the bombing of several U.S. airliners, bombing U.S. embassies overseas, and hitting other U.S. targets. Among the buildings in the U.S., according to Elmina, were another attack on the World Trade Center, the federal buildings in San Francisco, and in a place he called Oklahoma, parenthetically Oklahoma. Again, before we continue here, note that the designation of these Middle Eastern people as Iraqis should be taken with a grain of salt. They may actually have been Iraqi nationals. One of the things that we've looked at in connection with September 11th and related machinations is that Iraqi nationals were deliberately utilized by some Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood elements in order to deepen the enmity that already existed between the United States and Iraq, which in turn was intended to deepen the enmity between the United States and the Muslim peoples of what the Third Reich referred to as the Earth Island, the vast stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, Asia, the Middle East, China, India, and the former Soviet Union, encompassing most of the world's landmass with most of the world's petroleum resources and dominated across its middle stretch by a large Muslim population. Returning to the Philly Manila Times article, was there an international conspiracy of terror forged in a meeting in an abandoned warehouse in 1994 that included Angeles and Nichols, whom he referred to as the Farmer? Did that conspiracy include members of Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government, or at least Iraqi nationals? Does the Abu Sayyaf group actually receive financial and material assistance from Al-Qaeda and or Iraq in order to carry on its campaign of terror? Elmina did not give precise, clear answers to those questions. She was relating what Angeles had told her not long before he died. There is one thing clear. Edwin Angeles did meet with Nichols and another, quote, American, unquote, along with some state-sponsored international terrorists. Elmina knew that she was dying. She knew that all our efforts to help her recover would not be enough to save her. She told me what she knew to be the truth, as her husband had told it to her. At the beginning of the interview, I asked Elmina why she was willing to talk to me about after such a long silence. She told me, quote, "I am going to die soon. I want to tell the truth about my husband so that people will know," unquote. Now, we're going to turn to the issue of bioterrorism, and again, shortly after September 11th, there were a series of anthrax attacks on media outlets and on key Democratic senatorial leaders. Those attacks have not been solved, and indeed, one almost never hears about them. In For the Record program 317 and 324, we talked about Dr. Larry Ford, who worked for the apartheid-era South African government's BW program titled Project Coast. He also worked for the CIA, and he also had links with unnamed far-right-wing paramilitary terrorist groups. In For the Record 386, we took a look at an article from the New York Times titled California Doctor's Suicide Leaves Many Troubling Mysteries Unsolved. That article was by Joe Thomas from the New York Times of November 3rd of 2002. And in that article, we looked at, among other things, the fact that Larry Ford was influenced by the Turner Diaries, in turn authored by the late William Pierce, who had an ominous foreshadowing of the September 11th attacks in 1998. Skipping down on this New York Times article, after Ford's death, Detective Ray said, the authorities learned that Dr. Ford had been a consultant to Project Coast, which has been accused of creating weapons for use against the enemies of apartheid. They also discovered that he had held extreme racist views and once told a girlfriend that to understand him, she should read The Turner Diaries, the anti-Semitic and white supremacist novel popular among far-right groups that prosecutors say inspired the Oklahoma City bombing. And skipping down on the story, we also note that Larry Ford's areas of operation also involved Nevada, specifically the city of Henderson, Nevada, which was also one of the areas of operation for Aryan Nations member Dr. Larry Wayne Harris. More about that in a minute. Skipping down on the article, again, New York Times, 11/3/2002. Perhaps the deepest fear in the entire affair was that Dr. Ford had been working with anthrax. That trail, too, has run cold. After Dr. Ford's suicide, the police got tips that he had buried anthrax in a gold mine. They searched fruitlessly in California. 4 months later, documents in a Nevada trash dump showed that Dr. Ford had been in touch with people involved in anti-tax and anti-government groups. Some of them had tried to use bacteria to extract gold from dirt. In December 2000, investigators searched a derelict gold milling site outside Henderson, Nevada. They found a separator funnel, a white liquid, and Dr. Ford's business card. A federal agent said they also found directions for making chemical and biological weapons, including anthrax, but that was all. The site's proprietor had recently died of unrelated causes. As we looked at in For the Record 419, and we reviewing information from FTR number 89, Henderson, Nevada was also one of the places that Larry Harris had been involved with, and he also had an anthrax stash, at first alleged to be weapons grade and then sort of ignored. He claimed he was going to be making vaccines. I would note that Larry Harris was a member of the Aryan Nations milieu, was inspired in part by the Turner Diaries, as was apparently Larry Ford, and that Larry Wayne Harris also had an associate who had a laboratory in Frankfurt, Germany, as well. So again, note that we fight to find Turner Diaries evidentiary tributaries running through not only the situation of Larry Wayne Harris, but also through Dr. Larry Ford, and that both apparently, at least for a period of time, were operating in the Henderson, Nevada area outside of Las Vegas. It had been theorized that Las Vegas might have been one of the target areas for Al-Qaeda attacks. It's viewed as the City of Sin. I would also note that some of the September 11th hijackers also visited Las Vegas shortly before they immolated themselves on 9/11. What we're going to undertake next is an article that we looked at in For the Record program number 373 and that we reviewed in number 380. This concerns a motel outside Oklahoma City that was apparently used as one of the staging areas by the Oklahoma City bombers. It also was apparently visited by Mohammed Atta and some of the September 11th hijackers or would-be hijackers. One of the people alleged to have been in this area was Zaharias Moussaoui, and an associate of Zaharias Moussaoui was seen at the same motel prior to the Oklahoma City attacks in 1994 and 1995. It also appears, according to people who were at the motel, that Timothy McVeigh and company were associated with some Middle Eastern people. Again, I would take the characterization of these people as Iraqis with a grain of salt, as one, I think, should take a grain of salt with the assertions by Edwin Angeles that these were Iraqis. They may have been Iraqi nationals. And again, one of the things that has apparently emerged as a strategic gambit by planners of Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood is to use nationals from a given Middle Eastern country in order to provoke hostility between the United States and the government of those countries, and in turn exacerbating hostility between the United States and the Muslim population of the Earth Island. We're going to review an article called The Terrorist Motel by Jim Crogan. This is from the LA Weekly of July 26th and April 1st of 2002. The article begins, and again, note, first of all, links of the September 11th hijackers to this motel. Note an associate of Zaharias Moussaoui's links to this motel. Note the links of the Oklahoma City bombing milieu to this motel, and contacts between people from the Oklahoma City bombing and people of Middle Eastern extraction, quote, Iraqis, unquote, perhaps Iraqi nationals. I would not necessarily assume that they were involved with the Iraqi government. By the way, Larry Harris also claimed that Iraqi nationals had entered the United States to launch biological warfare attacks. The possibility that those attacks might actually have been perpetrated by white supremacists of the Aryan Nations milieu or related elements in order in turn to be blamed on, quote, Iraq, unquote, and turn designed to exacerbate conflicts between the United States and Iraq, and in turn to exacerbate conflicts between the United States and the Muslim population of the Earth Island is not one to be too readily dismissed. If so, that would place that particular gambit along the same strategic lines that perhaps may have dictated the use of Iraqi nationals in some Al-Qaeda and or Muslim Brotherhood co-operations with domestic Nazi elements in the United States. Again, turning to The Terrorist Motel by Jim Crogan, LA Weekly, July 26th through August 1st of 2002, we read, "What happened at the nondescript roadside motel outside Oklahoma City was just a fleeting encounter during the twisted cross-country odyssey of the terrorists who would carry out the September 11th attacks. Mohammed Atta, alleged leader of the plot, and two companions wanted to rent a room but couldn't get the deal they wanted, so they left. It was an incident of no particular importance except for one thing. The owner of the motel remembers Atta being in the company of Zaharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, who was arrested prior to, quote, September 11th, and now faces conspiracy charges in connection with the terrorist assaults, unquote. If this recollection is correct, the entire incident and its absence from the public record raises new questions about the FBI investigation of Moussaoui and even the 1995 destruction of the federal building in Oklahoma City. Already, the FBI has endured a withering political and media critique for failing to aggressively investigate Moussaoui and his contacts during his 4 weeks in custody prior to the attacks in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Some FBI officials have responded by characterizing Moussaoui as only a major player." And we're going to resume with this account on the other side of this broadcast. Remember that WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs at a longer URL, available for download only on Real Audio. That URL is linked to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the Real Audio-equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfirelist is one word, SPITFIRELIST.com. There will be a detailed, annotated description of For the Record program 443 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Listeners who have inquired about supporting the work of Dave Emery can find a section to click on in order to do so at the beginning of each description of each For the Record program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 443, The Serpent's Diaries Part 2, subtitled Neo-Nazis and September 11th, being recorded on January 25th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.